Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Good morning and welcome to Borderlines. I'm very excited to be doing an episode that I've actually wanted to do for years, and it's finally come together. We've got two experts here to speak to us on the subject of trauma and trauma-informed lawyering. That's kind of my tie-in about this. So our first speaker is Dr. Sherilyn Jordan, who is an associate professor in counseling psychology and equity studies in education at SFU. Sherilyn's been on the show before, but we were total newbies at it at the time. I think she was on episode 4 back in 2017. And so, you know, this will be an opportunity to hear more what Sherilyn is up to. I also had the opportunity to work with Sherilyn when we did a conference from the Continuing Legal Education Society of British Columbia. That was back in December 2023. We did a panel on capacity, and in that presentation, Sherilyn spoke with a bunch of other lawyers. And so the CLEBC episode, Immigration Issues in Depth, is something that you can download from the CLEBC website for anybody who's interested in hearing that full presentation. But we're hoping to bring back some of the insights that Sherilyn brought at that time. And also, we're going to have a dialogue with Deborah Dunn, who's our second expert for today. Deborah is also, she's a registered clinical counselor with an MA in counseling psychology from UBC and a PhD in philosophy from the University of Toronto, but has been working in the counseling field for over 18 years. And my favorite attribute of Deborah is that she has been my clinical counselor for this whole time, and so has helped me navigate the stormy waters of doing this kind of trauma-informed work and having to do the self-care that goes along with that. So that's part of the tie-in for me there as well. So I think for starters, we're going to turn the table to Sherilyn to kind of walk us through some of the fundamentals of trauma. I'm going to be pulling up a PowerPoint presentation as well. So let me just get that on board. But in the meantime, Sherilyn, just feel free to introduce yourself and correct any mistakes I made in my introduction, and then we can be underway.
Thank you, Deanna. No, all good. I'm really happy to be here and to be having this conversation with you both. And I want to just share some of the work that I did as part of that panel we were on together, Deanna. I'll speak, but don't be shy about interrupting me and sort of asking questions or adding as we go. This doesn't have to be just me talking. Sure. But I want to help folks understand sort of the impacts of complex trauma. And what I mean by complex trauma are sort of the cumulative impacts of multiple or prolonged violence and threats. And I've learned about this work specifically with people who are escaping from persecution related to their sexual orientation, their gender identity, or sex characteristics. And so we'll be speaking a little bit about how that particular experience of trauma aligns with complex trauma. And so, yeah, here I want to really emphasize, I've learned a lot about this through formal studies and research and conducting professional training, but a lot of what I've learned has been in and with community, and in particular, the work of Rainbow Refugee, who supports LGBTQI refugees, as well as HIV positive refugees, and their work here in Vancouver for the last 24 years has been, say, instrumental in extending refugee protection on this ground in a more effective way. And I've learned a lot by working within community. So I want to just acknowledge that.
Yeah. For anybody who's not worked with Rainbow Refugee, I refer all LGBTQ claimants to the organization, and have found that like over and above just the legal type work that they're doing, just the creation of community for people who have newly arrived and have no idea where to go or who to speak to. It's a really wraparound kind of service. So really good stuff.
Thank you. Yeah. And that community building brings us nicely into sort of some of the guiding principles I try to bring into my work. Always working in a person-centered way that respects people's agency and self-determination. Working from a stance that respects people's strengths and honors our human capacity to withstand, adapt, and recover from trauma. As well as an understanding that kind of care and solidarity are wrapped up in each other, that healing and well-being are promoted by relationships, and that in communities where we experience a sense of belonging and a sense of justice being possible. And that's where I also see the importance or the tie-in to practitioner self-care, that our own kind of care for ourselves and being connected in community that cares for us is both ethical practice and absolutely vital to doing the work. I want to really emphasize ways that trauma is not something that just happens in the brain. And so I will be talking a lot about the neurobiology of trauma today, but the more that we learn, you know, the sort of the disciplines of psychology and other disciplines learn about trauma, the more we recognize that we have to understand trauma, not as an individual psychological experience, but recognize that it occurs in social conditions of injustice and oppression that create conditions where trauma happens, but also potentially create the possibilities for healing. And so trauma is occurring on multiple systems at the same time. And so it's sort of in our brains and nervous systems and bodies, which are connected to relationships, which are connected to our broader societies. It's a profoundly social phenomenon.
There has been a real evolution in that understanding, like in quite recent years too. Like this is even just over the course of my career, just seeing how the neurobiology has really been coming to the forefront more. And it's an understanding this is not something that you just have to mind over matter, but it's something that actually happens to the brain and needs to be addressed in that way.
Absolutely. And so I think it can be helpful to ground concepts and learning in examples. And so I thought I'd share the example of Elohe. And she is I interviewed her as part of my research. And so she's shared this narrative with consent. It's been anonymized. And I'll just perhaps read it out a bit. She survived arrest and imprisonment in Iran. She made her way through three different countries to arrive in Canada undocumented. And that's when she initiated a refugee claim. She was 25 at the time of her claim. Before I go any further, I'll reassure you that Elohe was successful in her claim and is doing very well now. But here's what she described of her experience at the hearing room. So it was the lawyer and his intern. We had a translator just in case. She was Persian and she was the worst one. She was so, well, like I could tell, she looked like how my mom would be so embarrassed when I was talking about my sexuality in front of people. She kept looking down because she was ashamed that I, like, she wasn't happy that I made it, let's just say. And I was scared of her. What if she goes to the Iranian embassy and tells them? I was so scared. I was paranoid.
I think this is really important because, I mean, I've been in situations like that where you can see the claimant responding to somebody else in the room. You need to really think on your feet. And I've had times where we actually replaced an interpreter because there was a personal association. Like, it's a pretty dynamic process where you have to be pretty alive, alert, and sensitive, as they say, to body language and everything else that goes along with that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so there was the presence of the interpreter who kind of reminded Elohe of her mother and some of the shame she had felt around her mother. And so that would work against her giving a good, credible testimony. And then there's also some of the ways that hearings kind of inherently hold threat cues for trauma survivors. The unfamiliar, very bureaucratic setting, unknown procedures, the authority figure who holds power as the board member, and then fears around confidentiality. And so, you know, claimants are trying to give credible testimony while working against all of these threat signals. And then I wanted to share some of the factors that make SOGI-esque, or persecution around sexual orientation, gender identity, and sex characteristics, you know, particularly likely to evoke a complex trauma response. All forms of persecution are reprehensible, but SOGI-esque persecution tends to happen early in people's lives, often within their own families or sort of relationships of trust. And then it's distributed. No place feels safe. Homes, schools, and neighborhoods all become places where people experience harassment and threat. And so that distributed threat and surveillance means that people are kind of embodying that sense of no place is safe. Mm-hmm. They're also experiencing, you know, a highly stigmatizing, highly shaming form of persecution. The discourses around LGBTQI people are pathologizing, or even, you know, sometimes they're treated as demonic or possessed. So it's highly stigmatizing. And so all of these conditions kind of line up with conditions that make a complex post-traumatic stress reaction more likely and more likely to be more severe. So that, you know, repeated exposure to violence in childhood, continuing in adolescence or young adulthood. It's often sexualized violence. It's often by trusted others or powerful authorities in an environment of pervasive threat. And then I find the metaphor of an iceberg helpful to think about ways that SOGI persecution can manifest. So on the surface are the things that we can see, things like violence, harassment, and that sort of daily stigma and microaggressions I was talking about. But less apparent and still pernicious are the impacts of social erasure, that kind of invisibility or silence about sexuality and about gender diversity. So people are growing up in communities where the language for their own sexuality and gender is absent or pathological or deviant. And so it leaves LGBTQI refugees struggling for language in the hearing room. Mm-hmm.
And I think that sometimes that comes across very, like when somebody is asked, how do you identify it's not verbiage that comes easily. It's sort of like, I had a client once say, are you asking me to identify with the devil? You know, like, are you asking me to do that? And so we might think that that's the politically correct question. What are your pronouns? But it's very loaded. And I think it needs to be unpacked in a lot of cases.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's, I think, an important part of the work that guideline 9 that the IRB now uses has done, is to try and unpack some of those assumptions that we have because of Western LGBTQI.
The coming out narrative and
exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you want me to, I can go into some of the neurobiology, kind of the brain and nervous system aspects of, of trauma, if that's helpful.
Yeah, 100%. I find this super fascinating. And it's really, for me, unlocked a better understanding and ability to sort of like kind of do no harm in my own practice, understanding where the actual, where the problem lies in a way and how it's mapped out on the brain.
Yeah. So sort of thinking about all the things that may be going on when a refugee claimant is trying to give testimony, recognizing this is going to be impacted by prior experiences of trauma, and sort of learning how our brains work under sort of optimal conditions and then traumatic conditions can be very, very helpful. I want to start off by saying, if you've been educated in the West, it's really likely that you were educated to think about the brain as almost a closed system, an autonomous system, and a top-down conductor for the body. And that's not, you know, we can thank Descartes for that. We have a philosopher in the house, so she can probably say more about that. But the more that we're learning about how our neurobiology develops and functions, the more we're recognizing that our brains are embodied, they're complex systems, and they're deeply dynamically in communication with our entire nervous system and our bodies and our environment, our relationships and the people and things and spaces around us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me, again, this was really... this was a revelation for me that trauma is not something that's like in your feelings. It's actually like it will show up on an MRI, you know? Yeah. And so I think that like, first of all, it's like a kind of legitimates everything that you see in practice. But it also does, it does really help you to kind of understand in a different way the obstacles that people face, because this is on their brain. This is in their brain.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a physiology to this.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Absolutely. And there's also a relationality to it, or it's interpersonal. Our brains develop and minds develop through co-regulation with our caregivers when we're young, and through all of our important relationships throughout our lifespan. And that's maybe a good time to mention one other way that our thinking about the brain has changed pretty profoundly is we used to think of the brain as something that developed only in childhood and then sort of stopped that we, mm-hmm. once we reached maturity. And what we're recognizing is that neuroplasticity, so the ability of the brain to change itself and develop, continues across our lifespan. And yes, it's most intensely neuroplastic when we are very little, like up through sort of ages 5 to 10, but that continues into our adolescence, right up through age 25. There's still quite a lot of neuroplasticity, and then throughout our life.
Yeah. I know Deborah's described it as like that waxy period where it can make, you know, where impressions can be more deeply made at those early stages. But I mean, on the other side too, this does create some optimism around the capacity for healing, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I love that waxy description, Deborah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And feel free to jump in here. I'm going to talk about the three systems. Oh, can we go back?
Oh, yeah, sure, of course.
Yeah, sorry. The three systems of the brain that coordinate together, our lower brain or our parasympathetic nervous system is in dynamic communication with our basic survival systems, our heartbeat, breathing, digestion, our muscle tension and reflexes. And a lot of this is going on out of our conscious awareness, but our lower brain regulates and tracks how this is going through something called interoception, sort of our sense of our inner experience. And then our midbrain, our limbic system, is the center for pathways that support emotional processing, remembering, and social interaction. So the hippocampus tags the emotional tone of memories, and the amygdala kind of compares that to the past to help us anticipate right now, is this going to be a safe place or a safe experience, or is it threatening? And it will very quickly kind of tag something as safe or threatening. And it's a little bit primed to look ahead for threats. When it does, And then the third system that I want to talk about is the limbic system, and it's in constant communication with the prefrontal cortex. That prefrontal cortex cues the brain system to get activated and rally our attention, and it cues the cortex. So the cortex organizes all of our executive functioning, our self-awareness that enables us to be creative problem solvers, to be learning, use language, thought, and planning in order to kind of organize goal-oriented actions. So when they're working together, we have that real capacity to make meaning of our internal and external worlds, to understand them and anticipate them. So we're drawing on the past to understand the present and anticipate a future.
And just to add a little bit, so in trauma, because it's not optimal situation, there's a huge threat to the person. The lower brain directly communicates with the limbic system, and the prefrontal cortex by and large shuts down. Mm-hmm. And the cortex, the ability to think and process, goes offline largely. So there's just this direct message of, we're really not okay. And then the amygdala in relation to the hippocampus, I agree, Sherilyn, will try to discern, how bad is this? Do we know anything about this? But not in words. None of this happens in words. It's all very primal, pre-verbal, and automatic. Yeah, just to add a little.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and so when all is going well.
Did I move too fast?
Can you just go back one? The other thing, I wasn't sure if you were going to say.
Or go forward, because we actually have a slide on the trauma. Sorry, I'm counting on this, that we can edit a little bit.
Yeah, no worries.
That's okay. I'll come back to that.
Back. There's a section on what happens during a traumatic event as well.
So do you want me to go forward more here?
Let's stay with the positive for a little bit longer.
Yeah, sure, of course.
And then come into the trauma part, if that's all right.
Mm-hmm.
So where were we? Can we go back to the modes of engagement? Yeah, that's so when all is going well, our lower brain and vagus pathways keep us in kind of a relaxed state, able to engage with the outside world. And so we'll call that our zone of optimal engagement or social engagement. Mm-hmm. Our parasympathetic nervous system can activate more energy to ready us for a challenge, or downregulate to recuperate and save energy. And so when we sense threat, our lower brain and vagus pathways work to either mobilize us to fight or flight, that sort of hyper arousal, or shut down and immobilize, that kind of hypo-arousal.
Mm-hmm.
And a flexible nervous system is one that can kind of return to that optimal engagement zone pretty readily. So we might experience a stressful event, but we can come back.
Mm-hmm. I think this hypo-arousal one too, I think, is the less understood one. I think that people, once they see a sense of agitation, a sense of fight or flight, they're like, this person's not doing okay. But when they move into a stage of hypo-arousal, they kind of, I think it's especially for adjudicators, I think it's harder to appreciate that this is not disinterest or lack of engagement. It can be an actual sign of the very severe nature of the trauma. And so I think that this is the most challenging one to, I think, address as an advocate in a way.
Absolutely. Yeah. Harder mm-hmm. to recognize that it's happening and a little bit harder to actually help people kind of mm-hmm. back from it. Yeah. I want to share sort of over time what happens when, you know, when we experience kind of positive or safe events and we're in that optimal engagement mode. We're then able to think, create, learn, and these experiences are encoded into our autobiographical memory. They're structured, they have time markers, We can recall them when we want to, with that emotional valence of being safe, of others being safe, and the world being kind of safe enough, all being connected with that memory. Then in contrast, I want to talk about what happens under conditions of trauma. So when there's violence or threat of violence, any event that's sort of high emotional distress and sort of shame is a, you know, an extreme, anything that sort of threatens rejection is extremely distressing. So our stress response is activated. And if that threat is high enough, we may go into that fight or flight mode. Our muscles tense. The beam of our attention kind of narrows to the threat. Our senses intensify. And that prefrontal cortex reduces activity to the cortex. So everything is in the here and now. Our capacity to learn, plan, interact, or be creative are diminished. All of our sense memories in that moment are kind of tagged with the feeling of danger or threat. And because we don't have the cortex online, there isn't that integration into autobiographical memory. Mm-hmm. It's often a very disorganized, highly sensory intensive memory.
Mm. Another thing that happens with the vagus system, which it's kind of useful, I think, to know that there's the autonomic nervous system, and that has the sympathetic branch, and that's responsible for activation and arousal, getting mobilized, this mobilization on this slide. And then the parasympathetic nervous system is the down regulator. And then there's a branch of the parasympathetic nervous system called the vagus system, and that has a ventral branch and a dorsal branch. And in this fight flight activation response, the ventral brake goes off. And that means that the kind of messages of, no, we can handle this, it's okay, we're still connected, there are resources, it's going to be okay, that goes off. And we just, the sympathetic arousal just takes over. Right. So that's when it, what's, whoops.
Oh, I'm getting fireworks going off. Yay.
I forgot that that happens. I will try not to gesture, although that's going to happen. So that's another thing that's happening, is that the balancing that Sherilyn was describing earlier, that comes when we're in a positive state. So we don't get out of a window of tolerance, that we don't get out of okayness into really not okayness. That check goes off. Right. And just to say a tiny bit more, because Deanna, you highlighted this hypoarousal, and you're right. It's for a long time, even now in the DSM, there's still the focus, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Psychological Disorders, still focuses on hyperarousal as the hallmark. The dorsal vagal system is what gets activated when in situations of extreme trauma, when all of these responses of fight, flight, freeze, and there are some more that I'll add as Sherilyn goes, they don't work. They don't work. And so the mammal, including humans, there's a kind of a preparation for death. And that's the function of the dorsal system. We get flooded with endogenous opioids because we're anticipating a lot of pain. We're already freaked out. We're already in a very bad situation. There's a lot of, could be betrayal pain, but there's going to be, if we're going to die, it's probably going to be lots of pain. So we get flooded with endogenous opioids, and there's a kind of a preparation for death. In the literature, it gets to be called feigning death, because it actually can be useful to go into collapse. Because if you're like a cat who's just about to eat a mouse, and the mouse just drops into dorsal and collapses and prepares for death, the cat can go, oh, well, that's no fun anymore. I'm just going to go do something else. And then the mouse can survive. And it's thought that got inherited right? Selected as a functional capacity to escape death. So it stuck as also an adaptation, as a response.
It's very, very loaded too, because that I think sometimes can be associated with a lot of guilt when somebody falls into that hypo. It's like, am I at, like, you know, I think that this does get very loaded for a lot of people. But also when you think about this person, the way that we've described the brain in this iteration, being testifying in front of a board at this moment when this occurs, I think it's already come quite some way that traditional notions of credibility have like that's been revisited, that the idea of expecting a cohesive, coherent, chronological narrative, I think there's some appreciation for the fact that that's asking for the impossible. But I think that this is why I think it's more complex, is when you can just see that your client's not quite there anymore, that it's different. There's nothing that's like, it's something that you have to kind of trust your gut for, but the person in that preparation for death mode, standing in front of an adjudicator and having to be questioned and interrogated at that moment, it's truly not optimal engagement. It's the worst possible case scenario, and you've got problems worse than just chronology.
Yeah, you're naming a lot of different things. I mean, one of the things that happens too in this sympathetic arousal is the speech center of the brain goes offline. That, you know, I don't know how many nightmares you've had where you wanted to and nothing comes out. So if that gets activated, you know, in a hearing, and Broca's area of the brain shuts down, or you're remembering that in an embodied way, you're not going to be able to speak. And then you mentioned guilt. And that's often too why people say, God, why didn't I do something? Why didn't I say something? It's because you couldn't. And talking, and the guilt can come up as, and addressing guilt can be helpful in advance. But the other huge, huge piece, which is really relevant to the work you do, is that part of that dorsal shutdown, the emotional experience is shame. And the deep reason for that is that there's my sense of it from my clinical experience is that there's this sense of, this is my fault. I am outcast. I am alone. I have done something wrong. And a lot of trauma survivors have a deep sense that there's something wrong about them, because there's this withdrawal of, as you prepare to die, from all people, from all connection. It's just not available. And it's because of me. So, and that shame can also be immobilizing. And when you're trying to draw someone out and find out what happened, because they, you will see them. They are exposing themselves to your judgment, potentially, or certainly. Your rejection and your possible disgust. Like the Iranian lesbian woman, it sounds like potentially that got mobilized, her shame, her own shame, vis-a-vis her mother and the interpreter, right? So there's a lot going on, and you're naming some of these things, and it's quite complicated.
It is, for sure. I mean, it could be that the interpreter is thinking entirely the opposite thing, but it's still the first person experience of that situation. It is there, and it will dramatically impact their ability to speak to their own experiences. And I mean, fortunately, the board has recognized a lot of this, and a lot of complex trauma cases are now being decided without a hearing. But advocates need to know in advance so that they can identify cases that might not be super obvious to the board, you know, to start.
Yeah, I've seen a huge shift in board members' understanding of and willingness to give procedural accommodations to adapt for people who have experienced trauma. And that's been an important part of the advocacy work that, that lawyers and others have done. I think here, I mean, Deborah, you've done a beautiful job of describing that sort of shut down response that is so hard to recognize, but really important to recognize as part of the trauma response. And particularly a part of the trauma response that is more likely under complex, sort of prolonged trauma experiences. And remembering that it is, as you said, it's self-protective in the time, you know, but stops being helpful in the present, and particularly during when you're needing to testify. I want to talk a little bit about kind of the memory impacts of a traumatic event. And Deborah, again, feel free to jump in. But here we need to kind of remember that when a lawyer is questioning an individual, it's not a process of extracting a neat story that exists in a complete coherent form somewhere in memory. When you're questioning an individual or when a refugee is in their hearing, you're kind of jointly integrating the fragments of memory into a narrative. And they're drawing on memories that have gaps and distortions in time and place. The closer that a memory is linked to a traumatic event, the more memory interference there'll be. And emotions like rage or shame, humiliation or disgust will be reactivated for the individual live as they're giving testimony or as they're reconstructing the narrative with you. As will some of the physical sensations and really strong sensory memories. So this is very much an embodied experience. Along with those sort of sensory things is sort of a feeling of I'm not safe. Often a feeling of I'm, you know, there's something wrong with me, as Deborah mentioned, that I'm defiled or I'm disgusting. The others are threatening and the world is dangerous. So those kind of that sort of whole sort of sense of meanings are connected with all of the sensory memories.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Sorry, Sherilyn.
No, please go ahead.
So just a couple more. There's a way that it's kind of useful to think of the amygdala, which is that little almond-shaped buddy that the arrow is pointing to, is really connected to the hippocampus, which is kind of a primitive memory structure. And when the amygdala fires and says, something's not okay, this is dangerous, the hippocampus is starting to grab what it can that's relevant to what's a dangerous situation. We need to know about that. We need to remember what's dangerous. But because there's so much cortisol getting flooded and all these other hormones to help get the energy mobilized to get into a sympathetic response, a fight or flight, we can't lay down narrative memory. And so the hippocampus grabs kind of shrapnel pieces. So there may be images.
Smell, sense, taste.
Taste, smell, but also behaviors. People can be kind of stuck in a kind of a behavioral response, like a bodily motions. There can be this sense of different meaning. Sensations in the body. Frozen kind of emotion that gets stuck as another aspects of shrapnel, but nothing coherent. So it's important to also know that what it's like to be a person who has this fragmented shrapnel, often intrusive out of nowhere, having an image or a sensation in their body regularly. You feel like a crazy person. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, under the influence of a demon or depending on the culture. So it's scary as hell. Huh. And as a practitioner for the council, it's important to kind of have a sensitivity to how difficult it is to be a person with post-traumatic stress or post-traumatic stress disorder. It's really hard.
Yeah. And it's not like it's like, oh, I'm remembering something from the past. It's something that arises in the human in a first person current at this moment way. I mean, I guess this is what we talk about when we're saying flashbacks or dissociation. Like it's there's no sense of the fact that this event has already occurred and that it's finished. It's being experienced in real time.
Yeah,
that's right.
Flooding.
That's right. It's stuck. It's stuck. And that's why it's post is kind of a weird misnomer. It's happening. The person is in the moment where their attempts to meet the threat didn't work. And without that arc of like, here's a bad thing, and I'm going to try to get away. I'm going to try to fight it. There's another survival response is a frantic cry for help, an attachment cry, help. There's freeze because fight or flight didn't work and nobody's coming. And so there's a kind of a orienting, can't talk, but in sheer terror. There can be at that moment a kind of a fragmentation where there is at least that where a person goes offline. Okay, I can't leave, but I can. I'll dissociate. I just won't be here. And if all of those don't work, there's this preparation for death, right? So the person that's sitting across from you that you're trying to interview is there. Even if they're not in a flashback, there's at least a part of them that holds the experience of they're not okay. And they haven't gotten to complete the arc, which is that one of those responses works, the threat diminishes, and they can land in a sense of safety and okay, hopefully in relationship where they can tell what happened. They can shake and cry and feel all the feelings that weren't available when they were trying to survive. So if that arc isn't completed, and all the people you're seeing, that arc wasn't completed, this person is in that state. And that's again another aspect of the sensitivity to bring to the contact. They're not able to remember. They could feel crazy. They could be drowning in shame and guilt. And they have all this arousal, all energy of it.
Well, this has been really part of the learning curve for me is that I think as lawyers, we have this notion of the need for vigilance to make sure that before the hearing, this cohesive, credible narrative is put forward. But I think over time, I've come to realize the way that you can actually be doing harm to your client by pushing for that when it's just too soon, when there's not, like when the healing hasn't had time to go on board and now you're trying to drag things that are only in these fragments and shards, they can't be converted. And so, you know, just understanding how you need to work with in a complementary way with people who actually have the skills to do the healing work. And also that our role is not to do that because I'm no counselor, but to just try and navigate the exchange with the board and say, look, this is not the right time. I will put somebody in front of you who can say, you know, whether it's from the Vancouver Association for Survivors of Torture, writing a report, some other kind of psychological assessment, psychiatric assessment to be like, this is not available now, but it doesn't impugn the credibility of the claim as a whole. And that really is the role of counsel.
Yeah, that's a hard job.
There are so many more tools available for that now than there used to be. And I think it really is important to take that sort of developmental understanding of trauma that Deborah was talking about, that for those of us who've grown up in sort of safe enough environments, we have learned how to move back into that optimal engagement mode. Whereas for people who with complex trauma histories, that sort of dysregulation is a part of daily lives. And it's only when people have a chance to kind of heal that they can come through this. I want to just briefly touch on the importance of clinicians' advocacy around kind of creating two distinct diagnostic ways of understanding trauma. And so we have kind of the more historical DSM-5 impacts of trauma understood as four sort of system clusters. And these are the ones that people are probably familiar with, those flashbacks or re-experiencing, avoidance of trauma memories and reminders, that arousal, so agitation and activation, and then consistent kind of low mood and negative feelings about self. Clinicians have advocated for, and now the World Health Organization recognizes, complex trauma. And so that includes sort of the clusters of the DSM-5, mm-hmm. alongside recognition of kind of long-standing dysregulation of affect and impulse control, so difficulties regulating emotions, difficulties regulating attention and consciousness. And so that can be that kind of going into that dorsal dissociative episodes or depersonalization fairly readily. Disruptions in our sense of self, including kind of sense of self as ineffective or unworthy, and disruptions in our capacity to build trusting relationships with others. And this is part of what can make people who have experienced complex trauma histories have a more likeliness to be re-victimized later, that sort of disruption in trust. People will become overly trusting too quickly, and then are more prone to exploitation or extortion. Certainly see this in people who have come as LGBTQ refugees. Mm-hmm. Re-victimization along the migration path is pretty common.
Even just seeing that dysregulation of emotions, I have seen with clients who, like, you know, they get a notice that the peering has to happen on this day, and all of a sudden they start behaving in a way that's unknown and erratic to themselves, and that evokes guilt and shame, and it's sort of like you keep oscillating between these various issues.
It can be helpful to think of, I always think of complex trauma as having so much to do with chronic betrayal. Chronic betrayal of, like, even like fundamentals of like in the context of genocide.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
The most basic things that we're meant to trust are completely unavailable. It's all wrong. Or chronic childhood sexual abuse, and what that does, for example, to trust. And I forgot to mention one of the survival responses, fight, flight, freeze, fragment, feign death, frantic attachment. Another one is fawning. And fawning is this kind of submission. Okay, tell me what to do. How can I please you? That kind of Stockholm syndrome, where you align with the perpetrator, which Sherilyn was just describing around, trafficking and that kind of shows up, that over trust that they could be, that can be a species of fawning, because it's useful to know that all that, can you go back one? That this one and the slide before, as well as these survival responses, can come kind of to be entrenched in kind of what looks like a personality of a person, you know, sort of always pissed off and irritated or pleasing. These can become procedures for how to do life, how to do contact, because that's all the person's got. They didn't get in the context of the positive experiences that Sherilyn's slide was describing, where people can just stay in a place of, I can handle things. They have a flexibility in what they bring to contact and challenge. That flexibility disappears as a kind of a rigid kind of stuckness to them. And it gets disorienting if you're counsel and you're just interviewing someone, just interviewing, and like they're all over the map. They, from one meeting to the next, it might not even be the same person if they've fragmented into different personalities or different aspects of themselves. They may be in this fluctuation between hypo and hyper arousal, even over an hour or minutes or over meetings. So it's important to kind of, I think it can be soothing for counsel to think, okay, it's all normal. It's all normal. I don't have to freak out. This all makes sense in the context of trauma. And my job as counsel would be, because I know we're going to get in close to time.
Yeah, for sure.
I can stay another 10 minutes, but it is to make sure that we're taking care of ourselves. Sherilyn's got this slide up around how we want to help the client stay in optimal engagement mode, but that's kind of predicated on how are you doing? And there's things that Sherilyn's going to bring up around how to help the client stay in that optimal engagement window. But they're also really, really good for counsel around addressing your own hyperarousal, because, you know, spoiler alert, everybody has a nervous system. and sitting with someone with post-traumatic stress or the actual disorder is really activating. And depending on your own trauma history and your own resources and your own level of self-care, the energetic field that gets set up between you and them is really important. So, like, take care of yourself fundamentally. So everything, I just want to preface, everything that Sherilyn's likely just going to say in the next couple of minutes is really important for the council too.
For sure. And I don't know if you want me to stay on this slide here, Sherilyn, before I move forward, but I think that that is really part of what I wanted to get at in this is that, you know, a lot of the time you find in this field that the people that are involved in this type of work come at it because of perhaps their own experience, like the wounded healer we've talked about amongst ourselves. And I think that not being aware of the way that you interact with the client, if you feel unsafe, so do they. 100% of the time, you know, and if you can figure out how to help yourself, then I think you're in a position where you can create a better space for optimal engagement. It's not like you can't come at this from a martyred perspective. It's always me doing this. But I think to do the work effectively, I think you really do need to attend to your own health. And I mean, vicarious trauma is a real thing too. And so,
Yeah, no, I mean, we've talked about the longstanding impacts of complex trauma. And at the same time, it's, you know, healing is possible. And healing happens in and through relationships where people feel a sense of safety, a sense of belonging, and a sense of, you know, a just world is possible. And so counsel can bring that to clients or offer that to clients, only if they're kind of in contact with those same feelings themselves. So we need to be in community. We need to be in relationships where we feel that sense of safety and belonging and justice. And we need to be, kind of setting boundaries that allow us to take care of ourselves, not burning the midnight oil, having the basics of sort of sleep, friends and community, decent food, all of those things kind of in place for ourselves lets us show up in ways that then we can offer and a relationship that helps our clients co-regulate into a sense of safety.
Mm-hmm. And I like this one that sort of like signs to watch out for, like what are the signs that your client is going into a danger zone, and what do you do as counsel? That's why I find this particular slide super helpful.
Oh, great. Yeah. I mean, this is sort of a quick list. Learning this work is best done in a classroom where you can kind of see and experience this, but just a few little signs to watch out for. And Deborah, please, you know, add from your experience here some of the hyper arousal signs that you can attend to. Shallow breathing up from the chest, you know, short and shallow. If there's changes in the breath and breathing pattern of your client, darting eyes moving around the room quickly, you know, as we would if we were, you know, shocked and feeling threatened. Changes to facial flushing, you know, sort of the shame feeling with your cheeks, you know, get all hot, that sort of flushed face can happen. Movement into fidgeting or shaking or trembling. I listen carefully to how kind of connected people's thoughts are. Are they, you know, are they speaking in a fairly steady pace, or have they suddenly moved into very confused, racing thought processes?
Change of voice, vocal inflection. There's like a, yeah.
Very much so. Yeah, it gets suddenly very, you know, much tenser. And then the one that a lot of people know to look for, but it's still hard to be on the receiving end of, people can move into agitation or anger or irritability, and that can come out as anger at you or your front desk staff. But just remembering to tap into patience there, this is a trauma response. Mm-hmm. Deborah, you wanted to add?
No, not the signs, more the other side.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, here are some really, you know, kind of, we'll call basic things that counsel might be able to do, is to like slow down, help people stay in the present, you know, here and now. Can you look around the room, name a couple things that you're seeing? Can you feel your feet on the ground? Would you like a sip of water? You know, I can see that this is difficult. Let's take a minute. And so, you know, not racing through when somebody's in this sort of hyper arousal state, but actually taking the time to ground can actually save you time in the long run.
100%.
So I know counsel's under time pressure, but like,
yeah,
this is actually going to make your practice more effective for you.
Mm-hmm. We're often under time pressure. We're also often under financial pressure because we're working on a legal aid tariff and we have, that's it. And so, but at the same time, pushing forward in a non-ideal state is not a time saver. It's not a money saver. And oftentimes, like, you know, when you feel you keep getting there, to bring on board another expert to help, you know, I've had interviews with clients where I had a counselor sitting there so that I knew that I had somebody else to say, okay, I think that this needs to be a break, even if the client is urging me to push forward, you know, sometimes it's really necessary.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of that hypo arousal, that dorsal state that we talked about, where people are really shutting down, so some of the signs to watch for, and again, these are a little bit more subtle, but really glazed or glassy eyes, that kind of spacey look, shift in a tone of voice to become quite flat or almost vacant, not quite there. Mm. A sudden shift in the tone of voice or a depersonalized language. So in English, it would be sort of shifting to the third person. or you instead of I. Now that doesn't work in all languages, but if you notice a dramatic shift, you know, people start using their own name to refer to themselves, things like that. That's depersonalization. That may be depersonalization going on. A shift in pace of movements, suddenly becoming much slower or sluggish, and speech also becoming slow or disorganized. You know, as Deborah mentioned, kind of Broca's area is offline. Speech is going to be difficult, possibly even impossible for a bit.
Even sometimes like a younger voice.
Yes.
And so like it's the, I mean, you say tone of voice where it's like all of a sudden you feel like you are actually meeting a younger version of the person. It's probably because they are there and you're here. And so,
such a great example. You're talking to a 10-year-old all of a sudden, just in the higher voice quality or the vocabulary used. Yeah.
One that I find really challenging to deal with is sometimes some people will smile and it's very off-putting because you're like, did I say something funny? Or you like, and it's, and again, I don't know where that person is, but if it feels like this is the part where I've really had to like learn how to trust my instinct that if it's like something doesn't feel the same or right, to just slow down. And that's really what I've learned.
That can be that sort of fawning response that we talked about earlier, where people have learned to kind of smile their way through a bad situation to get out of it. But
they might not even realize they're doing it, though. Oh, and that's absolutely the challenge. If an adjudicator sees the person smiling when they're being asked about a violent incident, it seems like it's hard for a person to read unless it can be contextualized.
Yeah, no, a lot of this goes on sort of not volitionally. Sorry, Deborah.
Sorry. Go ahead, Sherilyn.
A lot of this goes on not volitionally. So they're not consciously saying, I'm going to smile my way through this. They just, that's how they've kind of embodied getting through trauma. And it was functional in the past and not helpful now.
It can also be cultural. Laughter and smiling as a kind of a code of where it's okay. It's a kind of a dissociation, but it's a culturally sanctioned. I've seen that among Indigenous people and other people who have had really rough time in different countries.
Yeah. So as counsel, if you're working with someone and you kind of have that gut sense, and you're absolutely right, Deanna, you want to kind of start tuning into what's going on for your client on that sort of emotional and energetic level, and trusting your gut in terms of times to pause, times to check in. But if you notice any of these signs of hypoarousal, it's a time to kind of ground in the present. So it's always kind of ground in the present is always a helpful starting place, and work to help your client kind of re-energize a bit. So you might just call it to their attention. You know, you sound like you're drifting off. And then can you look around you? Have them look around your office. You know, again, you know, can you tell me a few things that you see or you notice? Bring their attention out of their body and into the room around them. You can even do things like remind them, you know, we're here in my office. It's Thursday morning, you know. You're safe with me. You know, you told me you were looking forward to a walk with your friend afterwards. You know, I always encourage people to have a plan for something happy or good to do after a meeting with a lawyer. Yeah.
I find also like sometimes Deborah, I know, even has like different smells. So, you know, like a smell of peppermint oil, something like that, that just like it actually, there's a reason why smelling salts work. They kind of bring you back to your present sense. Olfactories are really, really good for that. I always keep a bowl of chocolates in my office when people are talking. And when it's sort of like when you can actually really taste the chocolate in your mouth, you know, really, it's like, it's a, rather than being theoretical, looking around, find some green objects, like taste that chocolate. Isn't it good? Talk about it. It's really good chocolate, right? You know, and I think that I have found that to be very effective. And now I use that all the time.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah. No, the smell, I mean, that's kind of our oldest sort of survival sense. And there's some interesting research coming out on peppermint oil specifically.
Really?
So, yeah.
I carry it with me everywhere I go. Yeah. Honestly, I have one in my handbag because it's like, if I'm just like, you know, feeling something, it's just like, okay, here I am again.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a great one. And then I love the idea of using taste, you know, something fairly intense and pleasurable, like chocolate or dates.
Dates. Yeah.
Touch can be a good one. If, you know, people have, you know, a lotion that they want to rub into their hands.
Deborah has from time to time, like actually she throws a bean bag and the person has to catch, and it's like, it has to mobilize. And then they smell like lavender, you know? So it's like, they're silky, you know, it's like you have to bring your brain back online real quick to grab that thing. Yeah. It's really excellent.
Yeah. Those squishy stress balls, anything with texture, you know, so a bean bag is great. Mm-hmm. So yeah, things that kind of bring people back into the here and now and into their bodies in an energizing way. Just standing up, walking around the room for a little bit. Temperature is another good one, sort of cold. So splashing cold water on your face can really kind of reset the nervous system and help people come back to here and now.
Tea, coffee, I find those too. They both taste and temperature. It's like cold water.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, those are all great, great strategies. And it sounds like we'll get to have another conversation with Deborah about some of the other ones that she uses.
Oh, she's got lots.
Yeah. No, that's super. Yeah. This is where sort of the day-to-day work of a clinician is really good to tap into, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And I think that in terms of the new iterations of trauma work too, is that I feel like there are a lot of tools. I think in the past, it's sort of this notion that talk therapy was the one and only kind of methodology for dealing with trauma. And I think that there's just been an infusion of new and innovative ways of engaging with the nervous system, that, like, not to say that talk therapy is over, but just that there's, you know, when somebody is in a deep avoidance phase, it might not be your first path. So you know, just having a set of referrals to be able to send your clients to, so that they can have other options. And this is really what I would like for Deborah to be able to talk through with us in some more detail. Like, there are just so many different ways now with like EMDR and brain spotting and, you know, different audio kind of style treatments, that I think there are different ways, and just having a list of people that people can be referred to, so that they can actually start moving into the healing portion. You know, because it's the refugee process evokes so much that there can be a real deterioration in the person's mental health as they go through the refugee process, you know. Well, the things are happening, you're just surviving. But once you have to sit and reflect, I find that for some people, they really do bottom out unless there's supportive care that's offered at the same time.
Yeah, no, people can move through and recover from complex trauma with care and in community. But the challenge is, as you say, during the refugee claim process, people do not experience themselves as safe. They are still precarious. They are often living on minimal resources. Social assistance keeps people at poverty rates, often in shared housing where they're dealing with, you know, disruptive roommate situations, things like that. So it's people are not feeling safe in their day-to-day lives as they go through the refugee claim process.
And well, so this thing that you're saying about housing is a really important one, because there's such a shortage of housing, respite housing, that sometimes people with very different types of trauma or different trauma responses are being, you know,
housed together.
Exactly. So you have somebody coming from a refugee producing country and they're suddenly being housed with people that are coming off of, major drug addiction, and there's, and they can be screaming all through the night. And this, for somebody who's just come out of a war zone, it's like, it's really, really challenging. You're not dealing with ideal circumstances for optimal engagement, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not to mention the uncertainty around the process itself. Like, somebody has the power to decide, yes, you get to stay in safety, or no, you're going back to the place you came from, is grossly aggravating.
Yeah, no one can feel safe while that possibility is hanging over their heads.
Mm-hmm.
So you really, as counsel, you really are working against that constant sort of threat and uncertainty. And at the same time, the way you are, kind of the relationship space that you create with your client, and then the community resources that you connect people with, can make a huge difference in how people move through that period of uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
Really encourage good, thick referral lists. As you say, the field of trauma therapy has changed immensely. We no longer believe in that sort of talk therapy, catharsis model of trauma recovery. Most good practitioners are now practicing from kind of a staged level or staged model of trauma recovery, where the first stage is really just helping people learn how to create a sense of safety and calm in their own bodies,
mm-hmm.
before moving into any kind of processing of traumatic memories. And a lot of that processing of traumatic memories doesn't have to be done just through talk. Something like EMDR, where people are not necessarily having to say what they're remembering out loud. You know, they're bringing a memory to mind while processing it. There are much more sort of, care and attention in the therapy process now to when is it helpful to help people ground and stabilize in the present versus going into past.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot can be done during in that sort of period while people are waiting for their hearing to strengthen and augment their sort of their own ability to regulate, and that helps them go into the hearing room much stronger.
Mm-hmm. And also just that the objective of counseling is not to get to a place where you can relive and excavate the memories in a narrative way. There's first of all the recognition that they don't exist in that way. That's not how they were recorded. But also that understanding that the reliving is re-traumatizing, and so how to kind of integrate a kind of a healing element, so that it's not about whatever that might be. And this is, I know, where Deborah will have a lot to say too about mm-hmm. how that works, that it's not about trying to go back and recover. It's not an excavation kind of a process.
No, people can learn so much about how to kind of bring themselves into a sense of safety and into that kind of optimal engagement mode without having to do all of that excavation work. Mm-hmm. And so that's where therapy has moved.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And I mean, the challenge is that with the way that the refugee determination process has been compressed, there are some things about that that are really great, because the lack of the limbo period is shorter. At the same time, trying to produce a basis of claim within 15, 45 days, the notion, I mean, one of the hangovers from the old way of thinking is this notion that delay impugns credibility. And this is something that for me as an advocate has become like a major focus of my advocacy work, where somebody delaying in making a claim, delaying in leaving, that might just be because they were literally paralyzed in a state of hypoarousal. It doesn't impugn the legitimacy of their fear, nor the trueness of the risk that was there. And I think the credibility determinations, I mean, we've had many episodes on this with Professor Rehag and such, that I think has evolved much faster than this notion about what does delay mean, and how does that, how do you orient that with the presentation you've just offered in terms of hypoarousal? And isn't that a contradiction?
Absolutely. It's so important that you're doing that advocacy work. Delay in claim can happen for many, many reasons, very practical reasons, like not being able to find a lawyer, or not even for many LGBTQ refugees, it's they may arrive without knowing that a refugee claim is even possible for sexual orientation, gender identity. And so there's some really practical reasons that people might not start a claim within their first week of arrival. And then if we think in terms of trauma, people want to protect themselves, or, you know, are protecting themselves from having to relive traumatic events.
For sure.
Reaching out to a lawyer, you know, they know will ask them to document their trauma means facing trauma.
Sure.
And so there's all kinds of psychological reasons that people might delay claim that have nothing to do with credibility.
Totally.
Yeah.
And I mean, I have a case. I remember working with a woman from Afghanistan who had come as an economic immigrant. Like, that was the thing. And absolutely mobilized every possible solution to avoid going through a refugee process. Yeah. And this is the other great irony, is that a lot of people have been trying very hard to avoid the refugee process. And then when they run into barriers to regularizing their status, they're kind of forced into the refugee stream. So in this one client's case, she literally, after the Taliban reoccupied, she had no way of extending her passport. So even though she would have been eligible for permanent residency, she didn't fit into the immigration mold anymore, and was forced to become a refugee claimant, and highly, highly traumatizing, trying to do no harm. In working with claimants like that, really does need to be forefront, because when somebody has done that, it's not because of a lack of a genuine claim. Sometimes it's the most serious ones that end up like that, because the person will do absolutely anything in their power to avoid that.
A refugee claim is absolutely last resort, you know, for
last resort.
So yet another reason why the credibility should not be based on
how long it takes somebody to. But again, I do find this as a thing. I mean, a lot of people from various different countries, whether it's Afghanistan, Mexico, Iran, that they come as economic immigrants and then are kind of forced into the refugee stream because of policy decisions that are being made in the immigration sector. So all of the rhetoric we hear about false or bogus claims, like, I understand that there are that there may be a lot of claims that get rejected because they don't meet that very high test, but that does not make the claim bogus by any means. Nobody wants to go through the refugee process. And I think that's a real misnomer, that it's so easy, that it's so wonderful, that it's like I'm just tired of hearing people say, if only I was a refugee, I would have a pathway to permanent residency. And honestly, that is something that I hear on the regular, and it just. Yeah.
No, it's such a damaging myth. It's just not.
It really is. Really is damaging.
The process is hard. People who have tried everything else before a refugee claim may not fit the mold of kind of the expected refugee journey, and yet have a very valid fear of returning.
And even just the way that we have disconnected humanitarian and compassionate decision-making from refugee claims, from pre-removal risk assessments, you know, that like, you used to be able to do both things, and somebody could have a highly compelling humanitarian and compassionate claim, but they don't succeed on a refugee claim because there's a supposed internal flight alternative or something like that. Mm-hmm. They can't do both of them simultaneously. Like, and again, Minister Kenny put that out there as being, this is to prevent exploitation of the immigration system, but honestly, they should be complementary processes. And,
absolutely. That HNC process should be a safety net for exactly those situations where somebody has a legitimate fear of persecution, of torture upon return, and yet doesn't quite meet the threshold for refugee protection. You know, and
the threshold is extraordinarily high.
Very narrow. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we see that with queer and trans refugees at Rainbow Refugee fairly often, that there are people coming from countries where the laws are in flux, where their family situation means that, you know, the board member could look at their claim and say, oh, well, you could be safe if you move to this other, you know, internal flight alternative, those kinds of things. And yet their fear is very real and very grounded in the objective. And so that's where I see, you know, the HNC, humanitarian and compassionate, as being an important safety net.
For sure. And as you said, like with the law being in flux, just to say a little bit more on that, like sometimes a country has newly announced a piece of legislation, and that newly announced piece of legislation will cause a board member to say they are doing their best. They are now trying to recognize these concerns. But it takes years for you to find out if it's just on paper or if it's help is available.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Is that change on paper, is that change in the legislation being implemented in a way that will make a meaningful difference on the ground?
Sure. For sure.
Or is it just something that's put there to please?
To make the UN be the like, okay, exactly. This is because the UN rapporteur said you needed something. So they put something in, and it's, I mean, even when you look at how things have evolved in places like Uganda, you know, it's not very often you actually see a thing where the legislation is so clearly against LGBTQ rights, you know. You can never really expect that. Most times it's about what actually is happening on the ground, and those are of course so much harder to prove. Especially with communities going underground and, you know, living a concealed life, you know, proving that persecution is abundant. It's very, very challenging because nobody wishes to speak.
Yeah, no, getting that sort of public documentation and an accurate sense of what meaningful protections are actually available to people is very hard. And that's still something where there's huge need for improvement in terms of the national document packages that are available. They've gotten better.
They're not
where we need them to be, particularly for women, queer women, and particularly for trans and gender diverse folks. The information is not attuned to their particular risk and safety issues.
Yeah, I totally agree. And sometimes it's like the national the national documentation packages on the IRB's website, they're fabulous. They have the very kind of highly credible reports like Freedom House and Amnesty International, UNHCR, and all this kind of stuff, but they very rarely venture into local news. And sometimes the local news is where the damage is so evident, where there are, like, you know, articles about that are vastly shaming of entire swaths of the population and the most marginalized elements of the population. So that's a really good place for refugee practitioners to look. And sometimes they're not in first language, but to get your clients to help you, or even sometimes the interpreters can help, where would I find that this is such a big issue on the ground, and help you come up with those like local sources, because they might tell a very, very different story than what Freedom House has said, because it's just, it's not as contemporaneous, I find, or there's something like that. people are putting on their best show for the international surveillers, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I that's key, is that what organizations, sometimes even LGBT-led organizations, are doing is putting their best foot forward for the international community.
For sure.
And yet the day-to-day experiences keeping people's sort of social class, religion, race, geography, all of these things.
The intersectionality. Also, yeah.
Exactly.
That often gets lost. Yeah. It's very nuanced. And also I think for a lot of the on the ground grassroots organizations, they need to keep quiet about some of their deepest work. Otherwise they will be put out of business entirely, you know? So if it's a very authoritarian kind of a society, you know, if they get too vocal, too much advocacy, they themselves become refugees. And I mean, they often are anyways, but it's not easy to do human rights work in many of these countries, because it comes at the risk of death for real. Like,
yeah, no, they're doing it in a very careful way.
Covert.
And as you said, yeah, covert, with sort of tacit kind of don't push too hard, don't make us look bad internationally, and we won't clamp down on your organization. But yeah, the minute you step out of line, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, then yeah. Yeah, you cease to exist.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Want to get a chiseled look in the jawline? Sculpt and shape your jawline with added volume from Juvederm Volux XC. Juvederm Volux XC is an injectable gel specifically designed to be robust enough to improve moderate to severe loss of jawline definition. And it is the first and only hyaluronic acid filler approved for the jawline. Add volume to your jawline for a chiseled look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. Visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.